The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Welcome back to another UAB Director's Chair. He is the director, the athletic director of the UAB Blazers, Mark Inger. Mark, how you doing, brother? What's happening?
Man, I'm excellent. Thank you for having me, Tony.
It's wonderful to have you on. Of course, every single week we do some great UAB sports talk. We also talk about some college sports in general, and then we'll get into some classic rock talk. These are going to be the four most influential rock musicians' deaths that influenced us the most. Yeah, I know. This was a tough one. This was, and I did a show with Kip Kiefer a few days ago. We were doing the most influential celebrities, and so I'm actually crossing over because a couple of these rock and rollers were on that list as well. But yeah, there's you know, I know a lot of people remember about JFK. They remember where they were when Lady Di passed away. These are going to be our rock and roll deaths that most influenced us. So we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. First of all, what's going on at UAB Sports, UABSports.com? How's it going in the athletic department? And I guess, you know, while there's lots of sports going on, it is summertime, so school is out, but we also have sports going on. I guess everyone's kind of kicking around and waiting for college football, huh?
Well, you know, but not us. We're transitioning into the American Athletic Conference.
Yes, sir.
July 1. So here we are, ladies and gentlemen, going to join the AAC.
July 1st, that's tomorrow.
I know.
Wow.
I know.
How exciting is that?
And that's very cool. And our mayor, Woodfin, who's such a good guy and a great friend of our program, he gave us a proclamation the other day, proclaimed that July 1st will be UAB Day in Birmingham, Alabama, and we're going to light the city up green. We've got all these banks and corporate buildings downtown, and the interstate's going to be all lit up green July 1st, the night of July 1st. So I think that'll be really cool. It's just a fun thing to do. You know, other people go, well, what happens? And I'm like, well, it's kind of like Y2K. You know, we're all going to get up on Sunday morning and make sure that our clocks didn't go all to, you know, zero or to midnight or whatever. And computers and cell phones still work. And assuming that is the case, then we'll be right back to business on Monday. But, you know, it's great for not just UAB athletics, but great for UAB and for the city. You know, imagine this. And our provost said this when we got the invitation almost 2 years ago. She said, Pam Benoit, really great lady. She said, what I like about this idea is the ability to take our brand to these other major cities where we are recruiting students, not just student athletes, but students. And she said, you know, thinking about us carrying the UAB name to Baltimore and Philadelphia and Tampa and New Orleans and Memphis and Tulsa and Dallas, you know, places, Wichita, places that we had not been going before, is really exciting from a student recruitment standpoint. So I thought that was a really interesting point and one that obviously I agree with. And then, you know, just renewing rivalries with all these schools that we used to be aligned with years ago. And the one that everybody, you know, holds closest, obviously, is Memphis for good reason. So it's just going to be a ton of fun, I think, and something we're all just really excited about.
Congratulations to you. And I wish I had known that. I should have known that. So tomorrow's going to be UAB Day here in the great city of Birmingham and the great state of Alabama. Congratulations to you. I know you're super excited about that. I know you have a lot to do between now and the kickoff of the first. So what will be the first sport that participates in AAC?
Yeah, it'll be soccer. You know, our two soccer teams and volleyball, they start competing in August. So men's soccer, ironically, actually entered the AAC last year. So that's the answer. They did last year because when we all made the decision to leave CUSA, there were three schools, Old Dominion, Marshall, and Southern Miss, who left immediately. And when that happened, men's soccer sort of dissolved inside of CUSA. So we went ahead, and fortunately the American was willing to go ahead and take us on so we could have a conference season and a schedule to play last year. So that was, you know, very gracious of them. We are appreciative of that. But so that's what you'll have first. You'll have the two soccers and volleyball in August.
This is the UAB director's chair. He is the athletic director for the UAB Blazers. Go Blazers. Mark Ingram joins us every single week right here on a show you can hear at least 5 days a week on the TKR app through Apple, TKR or Tony Curry Radio on Android. That's Curry with a K, K-U-R-R-E. And one of our most listened to podcasts as well on any major indice you can find is Tony Curry Radio Podcast or UAB director's chair. I'd be remiss not to mention what your head coach Trent Dilfer said earlier this week. And the CBS Sports headline says UAB coach Trent Dilfer says AAC champion has best chance to reach expanded college football playoff. Then the next headline says from Barstool Sports, UAB coach Trent Dilfer is off his rocker for saying teams in the AAC have the easiest path in making the 12-team playoff. Your thoughts as the athletic director for the UAB Blazers, now a team that's in the AAC?
Well, I mean, I can only tell you the truth, which is he's right. You know, I appreciate those guys at Barstool, and I love their work, and they're funny and fun to follow, but he's right. I mean, first of all, we feel strongly that the American Athletic Conference is, you know, the best non-autonomy league out there, and I think that we've proven that over and over again, the American has, so we're excited to be a part of it, and why what he means is, you know, our champion is guaranteed a spot in the 12-team playoff. And so that's what he's getting at. I mean, I guess technically the SEC, the ACC, the Pac-12, the Big 12, and the Big 10, their champion all get one. And then it's the highest ranked champion of the other five, which is pretty ridiculous, but that's how it is, at least for now. So we feel like we're the best. And I think what Trent's trying to say is there's a wider margin from the best team in the American to the worst than there is, let's say, in the SEC. From best to worst, they're a lot more close to each other than they are apart. And that's what he's saying is that if you win the championship in that league, it's hard to do.
Yeah.
And not that it's easy to do in any other league, but I think he feels like, you know, we've got a great opportunity with our terrific school, the recruiting base around us. We got a great city, great stadium, great practice facility. We got a lot of really positive resources for football here at UAB that give us a great chance.
All right. Info@TonyCurryRadio.net. Info@TonyCurryRadio.net. We read your emails every single week. This from Tim. My question is for AD Ingram. How does the licensing for UAB Athletics merchandise work and other items on Fanatics in the bookstore? We seem to have generic items that all schools have. Does the athletic department have control over designs or do they pass it off to a third party? Could the athletic department launch their own clothing separate from these companies? I know Blazer fans want to see some new and original designs.
Yeah, so Tim, by the way, is a great guy and a great fan and travels games from out of state. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that, Tim, and his great support. Yeah, so just to kind of break it down in simplest form, like if anybody said, okay, I want to start printing T-shirts for UAB, they can do that, but they have to be licensed. So you go through a company. We use a third party vendor called the Collegiate Licensing Company. You register with them. You pay a small licensing fee to them that gives you permission to use our marks and logos. And you, let's say you're going to print a T-shirt and it says something on it. You submit that design to them. They kind of screen it to make sure that it's not, you know, vulgar or using profanity or something that that we would find to be, you know, embarrassing or something we wouldn't want to have. If it is something like that, then they reject the design. You can't do it. But if they approve it, then it comes to us and we see it for a final approval to make sure that we're okay with what they're doing as well. Because there are certain things that could be said or done on a T-shirt or a bumper sticker or something that maybe somebody at the Collegiate Licensing Company wouldn't realize is offensive to us for some particular reason that they didn't pick up on. So we have a kind of a second wave of defense there to make sure that all that stuff is appropriate. And, you know, we don't love necessarily everything that passes through, but as long as it's using our mark and logo properly, what we also try to tell ourselves is just because I might not buy it doesn't mean you wouldn't buy it, right? My taste in clothing is different than your taste in clothing and so on. So, you know, you try to you know, you try to do that. And then this same third party vendor helps us get into more stores. They try to, beyond the bookstore, they're trying to get us in, you know, Dick's Sporting Goods and Academy Sports and Walmart and, you know, different JCPenney's and other department stores to sell our gear. And, you know, one of the biggest complaints that I get is on that topic, you can't get the stuff at enough places. Well, the reason these retailers, you know, they kind of launch with us, they get excited, but if they don't sell enough of it, yeah, you know, their shelf space is valuable, right? So if they've got something else they could put on the shelf that would sell, they got to do that. And so I have gone back to those retailers and I contend, I say, yeah, but you've designed something that I wouldn't buy. It's hideous. What you designed, no wonder you didn't sell any. Yeah. It's terrible. Look at this. It's awful, you know. And just because it passed through that you did use the logo properly doesn't mean it's something that people want to wear. You know, it's not attractive, the color you chose or whatever. So, it's a little bit of both. I mean, coming back to Tim's question, we have some say, but not complete say. Yes, in theory, we could be the retailer. We could set up shop inside of, call it Bartow Arena, and set up a store, and we could, you know, hire somebody that did nothing but design T-shirts, sweatshirts, hat, you know, tchotchkes, all sort of bumper stickers and license plate frames. We could do that, invest in that inventory and that overhead, and then hope it sells. But, you know, the retail game's tough, man. Yeah. And we've got our bookstore. I credit the bookstore here at the Hill Center across the street from Bartow, who has worked really hard to improve there. You know, when George Snoozy Jones decided to hang it up and retire, the university bought that building and turned it into our honors college. But, you know, he had a lot of stuff. You could go to that store and he had stuff for little kids and it, like a really wide variety, and credit him. But I credit the bookstore for fully identifying that and agreeing with that and trying to fill that gap.
Yeah, I got three words for you. I got three words for you.
It may not be perfect, but they have really improved over my time here. I would say they've really worked hard at it, and they have improved.
Yeah, my three words: we be dragons, man. We be dragons. I love that.
We be dragons.
We be dragons. I love that. You know, it's amazing too, because I mean, you and I are about the same age. It used to be 20, 30 years ago, you didn't mess with your brand. I mean, your brand stayed the same. Yeah. The font stayed the same. The color scheme stayed the same. You didn't change your uniforms. The only time you changed your uniforms is because you went on the road. And now you got NFL teams changing uniforms almost every single week. But they realize that there's a lot of money to be made there. And certainly colleges are doing the same thing. You're changing your helmet. You're changing your jersey. You're changing your apparel. Let me ask you this. And I know that you've got the special children's hospital game you do. You do all kinds of special games where you change your uniforms and stuff like that. But when it comes to apparel for fans, how often do you want to change things up? Because if you keep coming out with new stuff and it's not selling, your stuff is selling a hell of a lot better than it was just 7 or 8 years ago. Let's not be silly. I got a closet full of the stuff, right? And then you changed over to Under Armour. But I mean, how often do you get new stuff in? Is it just once a year kind of thing? Does it happen 3 or 4 times a year?
Yeah. It's seasonal. Every season there's a fresh new, you know, the T-shirts and short sleeve things, the hot weather, warm weather gear that they're getting now for the upcoming football season. And then they'll get, you know, hoodies and other sweatshirts and jackets and things for the winter season. Yeah, that's fresh and new several times a year again, and then do it for the spring. So, you know, it's a constant rotation. But you know, what the bookstore does is cater mostly to college kids and above, you know, thinking alumni, parents, that sort of thing.
You got some talls down there, by the way? You got some talls down there at the Hill Center?
Some what?
Talls. Oh, talls. Extra talls for like good-looking disc jockeys like myself who are 6'4" and got,
good,
you know.
Extra tall. I don't know if you're 6'4", Tony. I'm not sure.
I'm 6'7" with heels. I can tell you that much. No, you should. I mean, and I say this because last time I went to an Alabama football game, I went to one of their, I'm thinking they're going to have talls. They didn't have a tall in the entire store. I'm like, what am I supposed to wear? I can't wear a long sleeve shirt. It goes up to my elbows. I'm just telling you, I would buy 5 or 6 shirts from you right now if you could tell me there were talls down at the Hill Center. I drive in the car during the show and go buy it.
We're going to get you 2 and sew them together.
It's a what my mom used to do. One pair of jeans lasted 4 years. What are you talking about, man?
Patch on the knee, you get patches on the knees.
Yeah. Mark Ingram, he's the UAB Athletic Director. This is the UAB Director's Chair. We do it every single week right here. You can hear at least 5 days a week on the TKR app. Download that TKR app. It's free. I was listening to it all weekend long. Great classic rock and roll. And we just celebrated our 1,000th podcast episode. I forget which show it was, but we have 1,000 podcasts up wherever you get your favorite podcast, so check it out. More email questions here. Nikki, real quick, before we get into our classic rock platform here. Nikki wants to know, should we even use the words student-athlete anymore because of NIL?
Great question. You know, they still go to school. You know, these kids do go to school, and they do, you know, our goal hasn't changed, which is we are here to help these young men and women get a college degree. We think we have a great pathway to that. There's a lot of people who would not otherwise go to college without the opportunity. So we think that, you know, our mission has not changed in that regard. And I will say this to brag a little bit on our student athletes. For the first time in school history, we won the Conference USA Academic Award. And in our very last year in Conference USA, what that is, you take every GPA of all of our student athletes, you average them together, and that number is higher than anybody else in the conference. Rice has held that for years, and we won that this year for the first time ever. So really proud of them, but also proud of our coaches and our support staff, that our academic support staff, for all their hard work and making that an area of emphasis and a priority that our kids do well in school. And so, you know, it's something we're really proud of. But her question is a good one. And something that I'm worried about, Tony, is these sort of, you know, these bills that keep getting kind of introduced and talked about, which is to make student athletes employees. And, you know, student athletes wanting to unionize, you know, the concern that I have, and there's several of them, is if you were an employee, don't drop the ball on Saturday because you might get fired on Sunday. Right.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And they're kids. I don't care how old you say they're legally old enough to vote. They're children. You know, they're 18 to 22 year old kids allowed to vote. Yes. Drive a car. Yes. Join the military, yes, but they can't get a rental car, you know, and so, you know, these young people, like all of us, make mistakes. So that's something I'm concerned about. I'm also concerned about if they were employees and not an educational component, how would Title IX apply to them? If they're not required to go to school, how does Title IX apply? Well, now I think you're going to see more and more people eliminating sports. Well, I don't like that. Title IX has done a wonderful job of ensuring balance and that we're providing a very wide variety of opportunities for young men and young women. And it also, college athletics, as a result of that, happens to be the primary feeder and training ground for the United States Olympics.
True.
And so I don't know about you, man. I love the Olympics. I love the Olympics. And I love that my country, these here United States, dominates the Olympics, particularly in the summer. But where do you think all these kids train as track athletes and swimming athletes? Where do you think all that happens? Yep. What happens on our college campuses? But if all of a sudden we go to an employee model, then every single sport that doesn't generate revenue and, quite frankly, a profit has worrying to do, because we may not have those sports anymore. And anyway, there's a lot more at stake with that decision than just, you know, compensation.
I've been to 5 Olympics myself. I did it with the radio network, the Coca-Cola radio network, when I first got to town, and I went to every stinking Olympics from, what is it, 88 all the way through 96. So, yeah, I became a big lover. I was so fortunate. I wish I was, gosh, I look back on that. And I just rode along, man. I just had such a good time. Everyone just kept telling me, don't cause an international incident.
Don't mess it up.
I said, try not to screw it up. All right. He is Mark Ingram, the athletic director for the UAB Blazers. Every single week, we do something that has to do with classic rock. I bring this up because this year alone, we've lost Jeff Beck, David Crosby. We've lost Tina Turner. We've lost Gordon Lightfoot. We lost Robbie Bachman of Bachman Turnover Drive. We lost Gary Rosenthal. That's just this year alone. And this past Sunday, Farrah Fawcett passed away on that day back in 2009. And the only reason a lot of people don't remember that is because Michael Jackson passed away about 2 hours after she did. It's horrible because Farrah Fawcett should have been something we really should have celebrated. I mean, she's got the all-time best-selling poster of all time. There wasn't a 12 to 16-year-old boy that did not have that poster somewhere in his bedroom or in his underwear drawer. And then Michael Jackson has to come along and pass away and steal her thunder, because I can remember watching nightly news and you could tell they had a whole piece set up on Farrah Fawcett and they had to scrap it because Michael Jackson had died. Yep. So I wanted to get into the four rockers' deaths that have had the biggest impact on Mark Ingram. Do you have some honorable mentions first, as you always do?
No, I've stayed away from that. I think, I'll give you one. this is a cool story. And I can't remember if I've told this or not before. So Tom Petty, who I loved, love his music. Tom Petty's from Gainesville, Florida. And the very first year, 2017, when UAB reinstated football, we played a game down at Florida in Gainesville. Mm-hmm. Well, Tom Petty had just died the week before. And at the end of the third quarter, they make an announcement, their PA announcer, they wanted to pay tribute. Ladies and gentlemen, this past week, the following week, we lost one of Gainesville's favorite sons, and Tom Petty, and he'll be sorely missed. And then they played a song. How did they choose it? I don't know. But they played this song, Won't Back Down, by Tom Petty. And the coolest thing happened, which is during the chorus, the whole crowd is, hey, baby, there ain't no easy way. And they're all saying it. And I was like, that was a beautiful moment. And I loved it because I was a fan of his. Okay, so even cooler than that, they now play it after the third quarter every single game.
That's cool. That's cool.
And it came from that. Accidentally happened. And that's how stuff like that happens. But anyway, so that's one. I mean, the impact of him sadly people die, and I loved his music. And it wasn't about his death that impacted me as much as that happening and what a cool tribute that was to be a part of.
Yeah, that's super cool. All right, is that one of your four, or do you want to start with your first one?
Well, you know, I'm going to say Eddie Van Halen. I loved Eddie and I love the music. And I was just so upset for him to die young in his 60s of cancer, which all of us have experienced cancer. It's either we've had it or one of our loved ones or very close friends have had it. We've all been impacted by this disease. And so it's not uncommon by any means. It's just, all loss of life is sad on some level. And people for whatever reason that seem to have, I would just call genius type talent. Maybe it seems that it's more tragic, or I don't know, but that's why people like me who don't know him, I've never met him, are sad, because I recognize and acknowledge his extreme genius. And so it's kind of a, You didn't just lose a person that was a father and a husband and a friend and a brother and so on. But for people like me, the world lost this genius, which is just sad. So Eddie would be my first one.
I'm going to piggyback on that. I'm going to agree with you, because I've got Edward on here as well at the age of 65. Do you know where he was born by chance?
Yeah, was it Hungary?
He was born in Amsterdam, and they lived there for 7 years before he moved over here to the States, and that's when he picked up his guitar. And of course, his death is only 3 years old. He passed away a little bit later on this year. Rock and Roll Hall of Famer in 2007. I never got a chance to see Van Halen live. I saw David Lee Roth live, but I never saw Van Halen live. But I do have Damon Johnson on my radio station. And if you ever get a chance, and I can send you a clip of it, and of course you can go to wherever we do our podcast and see a clip of it. We did our best guitarist of all time, and Eddie Van Halen was one of his favorites. He tells this wonderful story when he was with Brother Kane, and Brother Kane opens up for Van Halen down at the BJCC I don't know what year it was. And, you know, this is Brother Kane. They had just gotten Got No Shame. It was number one AOR hit. And next thing you know, they're coming to Birmingham, you know, for a big, you know, coming home thing. And he tells this wonderful story about being backstage before, about 2 hours before they do sound check, and having this wonderful conversation with Eddie Van Halen. They were stealing the beer out of the Brother Kane's Brother Kane's green room while they were stealing water out of Eddie Van Halen's. It was just a great story. If you get a chance to hear it, but check it out. It's fantastic. But I'll piggyback and go with Eddie Van Halen. What's your second one?
Well, we've talked about this guy before too, which is Prince. Talk about musical genius. The day that happened, I went and I had, you know, albums and cassettes and CDs of Prince, but I, you know, in the modern age, realized I had not downloaded. I downloaded like every Prince song that I could, the day that he died. I saw him twice perform live, and boy, was he special and you know, mysterious and unique, and but a musical genius who also, again, died very young, like Michael Jackson, who was tragic. He's not on my list, you know, certainly could be, but I just love Prince's music. Hated that he died so young.
And that was a doozy, and it's hard to believe that was April 21st of 2016. That was 7 years ago already. That was a doozy, only that because I thought Prince, first of all, at his age, I thought he was kind of through the drug thing. He was 57. And I'm not stupid. I realize that people in their 50s and 60s and even 70s, when you're rock and roll, you're doing drugs and you're doing whatever it takes to get on stage and do a great show. I just was really surprised because he always had his posse. He always had like 12 or 13 people. Whenever he did interviews, he always had a large group of people around him. And it wasn't an insecurity thing. I think it was more of a friendship and just his support system kind of thing. And I just would have thought he would have had more people around him that would have created an atmosphere where he didn't feel like he needed to use as much as he was using it. So that was kind of a doozy. That was really surprising. This is the,
Have you ever seen the Dave Chappelle skit about him playing basketball with Prince?
No.
Okay. So on the old Chappelle show, they did this skit with Charlie Murphy, Eddie Murphy's brother, who's now deceased. And, about having been out at a club with Prince, and that they were all leaving together, and that Prince says in this, you know, deep, mysterious voice, do you guys want to go back to my place and play some basketball? And they're all like, sure. And that they did. And Charlie Murphy, in the way that he had a funny kind of voice, the way he talked to you, he was like, man, this cat could play. He's like, man, we thought we were going to take these guys, and this cat could play. And, okay. So I've heard Dave Chappelle talk about that. And he says, no. He goes, that's not just a funny skit. He goes, that's a true story that we reenacted, that it actually happened. And apparently Prince could play basketball.
That's amazing. Also,
so not only could he sing, dance, and play like every instrument under the sun and write music, he also could hoop.
He could have been a Jelly Walker. He could have been. Yes. Yeah. I mean, he's got skills. All right. So my second one is a guy who, another shocker, just blew people away. You know, we all remember when Lady Di passed away, or when JFK was shot. And a lot of people, and I was only 14 years of age when this happened, when John Lennon was shot outside of his Manhattan apartment, by Chapman, I think a lot of people were just absolutely shocked. He was just on Monday Night Football several weeks earlier. And of course it was announced with Howard Cosell during a Monday Night telecast that his good friend John Lennon had been passed away. But that really didn't affect me then because I was only 14. What really affected me was about 14 years later when I was doing a show from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I was up on the fifth floor. They have a beautiful studio up there. And we used to do something around Valentine's Day every single year. We would bring a couple from Birmingham. We would marry them live on the air from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We did it for about 6 or 7 years. And right outside the studio on the left-hand side was a bed. It was a king-size white bed. There was not a stitch of any other color on this bed, period. And it was made out of church pews. There was a church pew in the front, and you can see the pockets, and there's a church pew in the front, and then the bed laid in the middle, and it was pure white. Every stitch, everything on it was white. And then right next to that bed was a white table with a white phone with a white receiver. Even the buttons were white. And there was a white sign with black lettering that said, this is the bed that John and Yoko slept in If it rings, pick it up and you can talk to Yoko. Well, you know what happened. I was leaving the studio on my last night. It was 7 o'clock in Cleveland, Ohio, and the phone rings. And I was like, and I got so nervous. And I picked up the phone and it was Yoko Ono on the other line. And I got a chance to talk to her. Yeah. And I, you know, first of all, she is difficult to understand. And I did. And I remember asking her, hey, can you hold on a second? I'd like to record this because no one's going to believe the story. And she's like, no, I only have a few minutes. But we spoke for about 15, 20 minutes. I did throw the question, did you break up the Beatles? And she laughed. I'm sure she's heard that question many times. But that was something that was so influential to me.
What did she say? What did she say, though?
You know, it was really, really small talk. It was, how you doing? Where are you calling from? She was in England at the time.
Tony, when you asked her if she broke up the Beatles.
Oh, no, she just laughed. She didn't laugh.
No. Hard-hitting journalist. We need to know.
Hey, you know what? We can fault women for a lot of things. You know, they say behind every great man is a better woman. It was John who broke up the Beatles. It wasn't Yoko. But I will say that something about Yoko probably helped John break up those Beatles, if you know what I mean. But it was a joy. It was great. So that would be my second one. What's your third one?
So I was a little kid, like four, when this happened. And in the moment, I'm certain that I can't remember that far back, but it was the following year after year. My dad was such a huge Elvis fan. When Elvis died, I mean, like every year that guy's death, the anniversary of his death, I mean, it was on the news. People would talk about it. They would show people at Graceland just bawling their eyes out, you know, and my dad, he was never sitting around crying, but I mean, he just loved Elvis. He was just stunned to the point where I do remember as a little kid, maybe not when it happened, but a year or so later, I remember asking my mom, did Dad know Elvis? Which, of course, he did not. You know, like they, Dad is so upset. Did Dad know Elvis?
That is
he talked about it all the time. So, you know, Elvis Presley, like John Lennon, was just, you know, larger than life type figures. And he's a Muhammad Ali-esque, you know, individual, superhuman person that at that time really shook the world and it vibrated through my house every year for some period of time.
You know, what's amazing is there's a lot of people out there, and I would probably say the majority of them didn't even listen to Elvis, but because he died when he did, and because so many other people were affected by his stardom and his fame and just the beautiful way he sang and everything he did to television, they feel like they knew him better than they, I mean, I know people that just talk about how when he died, it changed their lives, and they didn't celebrate his music when he was alive. You know what I mean? It just builds, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think a lot of people would say the same thing for Marilyn Monroe. I mean, Marilyn Monroe is well before my time, but I could certainly say she was one of the most influential deaths in my life because she got bigger after she passed away. And a lot of that has to do with certainly the age she passed away. So it was 1990 and I was at Oak Mountain Amphitheater about ready to bring on Joe Cocker opening up for Stevie Ray Vaughan. And we played a lot of Joe Cocker on the radio station. We had just come on the air about a year and a half earlier. We didn't play any Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I got a chance to meet Stevie backstage. I was a big autograph hound, and I had a couple of CDs. I had Joe Cocker sign a CD, and I had Stevie Ray Vaughan. He's got one of the most beautiful autographs in the history of the world, period. It's my favorite autograph, period, just by its beauty. It's just big looping letters. It's beautiful. And he was on a scooter, and I'll never forget it. And he just kept scootering around, and he would stop at a bunch of people, and then he'd roll off, and then he'd stop again, he'd roll off. And so it made it look like he was being very engaging with everyone that was backstage. And I said, why are you on the scooter? He goes, well, first of all, it's a hell of a lot of fun. He said, second of all, whenever I roll up on somebody and they'd start to creep me out a little bit, he goes, I just roll away. He said, if you walk away, you're being rude. When you roll away, it looks like you may have just accidentally hit the gas. And he just look over, show, I'm sorry. And he just roll off. So he's just rolling around backstage, but he was on his scooter for a good hour, hour and a half before the show. Hell of a nice guy. And then less than 3 months later, he gets killed in a pilot aired helicopter crash. And it was unfortunate that he passed away, but there are some good things that come out of every death, and that is all of a sudden our radio station started playing. I mean, I knew Pride and Joy, that was it. I knew Pride and Joy, but after that, we started playing everything that Steve Ray Vaughan ever played, and I'm so glad we did because I became a huge fan. The other thing a lot of people don't realize is he had a huge alcohol and drug problem until about 1986. And after 1986, he cleaned up and he came out, and that's when he came out with Crossfire. That's when he started winning Grammys. Of course, he headlined in Madison Square Garden for three straight nights. Steve Ray Vaughan, Madison Square Garden, three straight nights. He also did the Beale Street Music Festival. He had an entire festival with over 100 blues acts that were centered around him. The guy was a legend, and he's one of the few guys where you hear his guitar, you know exactly who you're listening to. So I'm going to go with Steve Ray Vaughan, not only because he's one of the greatest blues guitarists of all time, but because I got a chance to meet him before he died, which is pretty amazing.
Well, that's cool, man. I love his music, too. What a great sound.
Yeah.
Slide guitar and his great bluesy sound.
All right, I'm ready for a doozy. I'm ready for a doozy. You always throw out a doozy. Now you always throw out one that I'm kind of like, wow, and I'm thinking this is going to be it.
Yep, Mick, you're right. I'm mixing it up. So I grew up. I loved watching stand up comedy as a kid. I loved watching it. I was always really impressed by it. I loved good storytelling. For whatever reason, I love to listen to a good story. I love anybody that can tell a good story. I like to think I tell a pretty good story. And it's all because I grew up loving that. And part of what I grew up loving watching was Saturday Night Live. I loved watching Saturday Night Live, the original cast, and not just the original cast, but some of those original casts with Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase, and God bless him, John Belushi. Oh, and so John Belushi is going to be my last one. Part of the Blues Brothers with Dan Aykroyd. What a great entertainer. And I just was so sad when he died in the early 80s. And again, I was young. I mean, man, that tells you how early, like I started watching that show way before I should have in terms of whether it was appropriate. I was staying way up too late watching that show way too early as a kid. And, but man, I was like sick about it. I was really upset. And, the Blues Brothers movies, and it was funny and fun, but it was good too. And so that's going to be my last one.
Man,
big impact.
You have totally made me flip on my last one. I give you kudos for that because I didn't even think about, I didn't even think about comedians, and you just gave me, because I was going to go with Tony Lewis, the lead singer of The Outfield. I saw The Outfield open up for Night Ranger at Timberwolf Amphitheater up in Westchester, Ohio, and I got a chance to meet the band. I got their autographs, and he was one of the nicest guys in rock and roll. I was going to go with Tony Lewis, but there was another comedian that had sold out the Louisville arena. This was 1986, and his tickets went on sale, and between the time he announced he was going to play Louisville and then the time he actually played the date, he actually just exploded. There was a guy named Carl LaBove, LaBove, who opened up every single one of his shows, and I was to bring this this guy on, and it was Sam Kennison. And Sam Kennison, and Sam Kennison came up to me before the show, and he said, "Listen," he goes, in his snarky, "Listen, I get all these old guys, I get all these old guys always bringing me up on stage, and they're always like, ladies and gentlemen, Sam Kennison." He goes, "Get up there and fire up the crowd, get the crowd." He goes, "If you don't drop about 15 F bombs before you walk off stage, get back out there and do it again." And I said, "Okay." So I get up there, I'm like 19, 20 years old, something like that. And my boss is sitting in the front row. I got a pair of sunglasses on. It's 8 o'clock at night, much like the Blues Brothers. And I get up there and I just start dropping F-bombs, and the crowd is going crazy, like frenzy crazy. I don't even remember what I said. "Are you ready for an effing good time?" I mean, I was throwing out as many F-bombs as I could. My boss is looking up at me. His eyes were about falling out of his head. Like, what are you doing? And so Sam comes out and just absolutely kills it. Well, I go backstage. And Carl's like, "Man, don't leave. I want to talk to you before the end of the show." And I said, "Okay." So I hung out backstage and we watched the show. And Carl said, you're a disc jockey. You work 7 to midnight. I know you have roads to things we need. I'll put it that way. Extracurricular activity things. And I said, Sure. And so he asked me to get something particular, a drug of choice, a DOC. And he said, can you get me some of this for Sam and I? And I said, sure. And so I made a phone call. And of course, you know, we had beepers back then. We didn't have cell phones. I got a beeper. And I was living with this girl who was allowing me to stay at her place for a little bit while my apartment was getting ready. And so I went over to her apartment and I told these guys, I told Carl and Sam, I said, here's where this girl lives. Meet me there. And then we can go out from there or we can do whatever you want. I can't believe I'm sharing this story because it was crazy. So I get to her place. She gets up. How was the show, honey? I said, it was great. It was fun. We had a good time. I said, hey, listen, a couple of friends of mine are coming by your apartment in just a little bit. I just want to give you a heads up. And she goes, okay, well, don't make it late. I have to work early tomorrow morning. I said, okay. So about 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, I get a phone, I get a knock on the door and I open it up. And there is Sam Kennison with the long black trench coat with the beret on, the long hair, and he's sweating. And he's with his friend Carl. And they come walking in and he goes, where is it? Where is it? Where is it? And, you know, so I lay it out on the table. And my girlfriend gets up and she sees the three of us around this, you know, pile of and she's like, what in the hell are you guys doing? And I said, oh, you're not going to believe who's
nothing
here.
Nothing to see here.
I said, you're not going to believe who's here. I said, this is Sam Kennison. Well, she had no idea who Sam Kennison was. And she's like, get this stuff out of here or I don't ever want to see you again. And Sam goes, who's the bee? Who's the bee? Who's the bee? And he, of course, he wasn't saying bee. He was saying, and I... And I started laughing and she said, get out now. And I said, I'll be home in a few hours. And she goes, do not come back here. Do not come back here. And so we left and that was the end of the night. I don't really remember what happened from that point on. And then unfortunately, and I couldn't tell you exactly how long it was, but unfortunately Sam cleaned up. I mean, he did a version of Wild Thing. I mean, he was dating Jessica Hahn. And
you're lying, cheating, untruthful, trap, and I think I love you.
He,
you remember that line?
Yes.
He goes, you're a lying, cheating, untruthful, trap, and I think I love you.
And he cleans up, and how does he die? He got killed by a drunk driver on a two-way street in Las Vegas. And I was like, of all the ways for Sam Kennison to die, to be killed by a drunk driver when he was sober at 2 o'clock in the morning was just amazing to me. So thank you for bringing that up. And thank you for reminding me that. What's that?
And you know, he got his, he was a minister.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
He, you know that?
He did a total flip. Yeah, he did. But he was
before he was a comedian.
Yes. Yes. He was a minister.
Before he was a comedian, he was a minister.
You're right. You're right. He used to do all of the, he was huge at WEBN up in Cincinnati, and he used to do all of their imaging. He was huge. It was unbelievable. Great stuff, man. Great stuff.
He
all right. UABSports.com, UABSports.com. As always, Mark, I love having our conversations. We'll do it again next week. Next week, of course, will be the 4th of July week, so don't forget about me. We'll get after it, and we'll throw up. And next week, you get to pick the topic, okay?
Sounds good, man. Have a great weekend.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.